Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
It's hard being a kid brother. I speak from experience. Old neighbours often call me by the name of my big brother, whose footballing exploits I never matched. But I've had it easier than Jack Butler Yeats. My big brother didn't win the Nobel Prize for Literature, wasn't considered the greatest poet of his era, and didn't possess a self-important public aura. Not that the Yeatses were rivals. W.B. was a supportive older brother and threatened by his sibling's talent. But when a big brother spends his life weaving a personalised mythology and a kid brother declines to mythologise himself, it's hard to escape that big brother's shadow. Nothing better sums up their difference than their epitaphs. W.B.'s epitaph was austere. Cast a cold eye on life, on debt, horsemen pass by. Jack's epitaph was whimsical when told to a friend before his debt. I have travelled all my life without a ticket, and therefore I was never to be seen when inspectors came round, because then I was under the seat. It was rather dusty, but I used to get the sun on the floor sometimes. They chose their wives differently too. When W.B. finally married, his bride was half his age and humiliatingly knew that she was his third choice, his other two proposals having been recently rejected. Jack was 20 when he became engaged to a fellow art school student, affectionately nicknamed Cotty. He spent 3 years working in a fireless room, producing comic magazine sketches until he earned enough to give his bride a home. Jack and Cotty were childless, but shared a compatible happiness for 53 years until she died in 1947. Jack never lost his childlike sense of wonder. While his elder brother dabbled in the occult and astrology, Jack enjoyed creating puppet shows for children and making model boats with the poet John Masefield. His early illustrations were simple depictions of West of Ireland life, but also captured the circuses he enjoyed with boyish enthusiasm. These early drawings don't only convey sweetness. He illustrated the dreadful poverty that J.M. Singh chronicled in newspaper articles when they travelled through Connacht. But while capturing that poverty, he also caught people's defiant spark. What he witnessed never left him. But what makes him remarkable is that he described everything twice. He did so straightforwardly as a young man. But walking in aisles when older, he revisited those memories in a way that made him a great artist. His starting points in the latter paintings didn't change. Irish landscapes, ponies, travelling shows. What changed was his depiction. He painted the layers of emotion within his memories so that his canvases became not external landscapes, but internal ones infused with grief and passion. He ceased being a factual illustrator, but chronicled the human heart, even if this initially baffled his small audience. His monumental works were painted in a state he described as half memory, the original landscapes distorted with vibrant emotional colour, flowing so quickly that brushstrokes weren't enough, daubs of paint were squeezed onto the canvas and moulded by his fingers. In conservative Dublin he was mocked, but a new generation of writers were mesmerised by the audacious free-flowing freedom of these paintings, by extraneous forces crowding at the canvases to give the logic of dreams. Young Samuel Beckett was in awe of him. James Joyce treasured a Yeats painting. It took Ireland a long time to realise how the young sibling was as great an artistic force as his famous brother. But Jack B. Yeats was too engaged with life to worry about fame. Not that he was reclusive. Callers at a city centre studio were served Madeira with twists of lemon peel. If persuaded to stroll along Fitzwilliam Street, he brought his visitors flowers from street sellers, regaling them with stories of beggars he had befriended. After his wife's death, he entered an old folks' home at Portobello Bridge. The modernist poet Thomas McGreevy visited every night, no matter how late the hour. Overhearing McGreevy's chatter, residents complained that Yeats has the BBC radio on every night after midnight. Jack Yeats chose to travel without a ticket and hide from inspectors. But the kid brother has emerged from his big brother's shadow to become recognized as Ireland's greatest 20th century painter, his textured masterpieces displayed in the National Gallery. I think of him whenever I walk the canal bank near Portobello Bridge, knowing how he loved to leave his nursing home and walk there immersed in life. 2 days before he died, aged 86, he made his final drawing, two swirling ponies on a funfair roundabout. That captures him, joyous to the last, wrapped in wonder, and unpreoccupied by any thoughts of genius.
The picturesque village of Kitzbühel nestles high in the Austrian Alps. Both a winter and summer resort, it is also home to the most difficult course on the downhill skiing calendar. The Hahnenkamm has hosted many spectacular races over the years, not least when the national favourite, the sonorously named Franz Klammer, won an historic 4 victories in the 70s, the highly partisan crowd ringing cowbells, as is their tradition, to will their boy down the impossibly steep slopes. In 1944, when Austria was under Nazi rule, Richard Urbanski, a 23-year-old Pole from Krakow, married his young bride in the Catholic Church in Kitzbühel. Richard had been working for a Polish businessman who had asked him to transport some horses by lorry to stables in the Alpine village. Richard had witnessed the daily horror of Nazi occupation in Poland and sensed that this was an opportunity to escape to a freer world. He convinced his girlfriend to join him, and they made the arduous journey through countless checkpoints with the fear of uncertainty that war brings to those trapped in its talons. As Germany slid inexorably towards defeat, he decided it was safer to move closer to the Allied lines in hope of finding refuge from the disintegration of the Nazi regime and the new impending threat of Soviet occupation. The Poles had traditionally feared Russian oppression much more than German occupation, as Germany was considered by its neighbors as the center of civilization. Although people feared for the future, when the invasion came in the autumn of 1939, the consensus among Poles was that the occupation would be benign. So when a fresh-faced 17-year-old Richard Urbanski cycled home from school one day and witnessed religious Jews being physically thrown out of a third-floor window by the SS onto a truck below, his understanding of the world was changed forever. Reliving the horror of what he had seen to his parents, his father sat him down and told him to be grateful that Poland had so many Jews, because once the Nazis have finished with them, they'll start on us. Richard's innocence had been stolen in a few moments of unhinged brutality, violated in a manner he would never recover from. Some years later, newly married, he and his bride made their way west to Italy, now in Allied hands, where they joined up with a British regiment that included a battalion of exiled Polish soldiers. As the war was ending, they were transported to England and began a new life in London. He found work on the railways as a ganger, laying tracks, while she looked after their newly born daughter. Within 2 years, the marriage was over. His wife had abandoned him and the child and run off with another man. Life for Richard became unrelenting hardship. Juggling a poorly paid, physically exhausting job with a small child in England in the late 40s was no simple endeavor. A few months passed. Richard met a young, single mother from Portsmouth on Lanark Road in Maida Vale. Annie was working as a waitress in one of the seedy cafes that lined the road, dotted between boarding houses and brothels. Richard moved into her small flat with his small daughter and her small son, and life for him improved immeasurably. In 1955, Richard's estranged wife asked him for a divorce, but he refused. His Catholicism was an important mainstay for him, and besides, he was deeply hurt by her betrayal and angry that she had walked out on the family. He was in no mood to make life easier for her. Her next gambit was to claim that they were never legally married on the grounds that the church in Kitzbühel was under de facto Nazi occupation, which rendered the marriage invalid. Richard was incensed at the prospect of his daughter's status becoming illegitimate. For years, the two parents slugged it out through the highest courts in the land. The House of Lords finally ruled in Richard's favour, and the marriage was declared legal. Lord Denning ruled that marriage in a Catholic church was valid regardless of the regime in power, the first time such a case had been tested under English law. Urbanski versus Urbanski became legal precedent. Richard and Annie came to work for my family in the early 1960s, and Richard became something of a surrogate grandfather to me. I can still recite the Polish nursery rhymes he taught me. I remember his unfailing good instincts about people and the unique way in which he mangled the English language. It was Richard who told me the truth of my mother's own wartime survival when I was 7 years old, something she did not talk about until very much later. And as to the terrible event he himself had witnessed at the age of 17, he recounted that gruesome episode at the beginning of the war over and over, as if I'd never heard it before, until the day he died.
What did you enjoy most about your visit to Japan, people ask, hoping to travel vicariously, perhaps, now that flying around the world for pleasure is taboo. Oh, the temples of Kyoto, Bob replies, while I deliberate. I could say how much I enjoyed the sight of my 6'3" husband, a man not much given to deference, bending at the waist like a well-oiled hinge and bowing his head over prayer-positioned hands to thank one kind Japanese person after another. I could mention the brilliantly punctual bullet trains, scoured and polished in the 4 minutes between arrival and departure by a fast-moving army of cleaners, women in cherry blossom pink uniforms and men in blue. Or, oh, the toilets, even the ones in stations with heated seats and a multiplicity of buttons to squirt hot or cold water in different directions, depending on the user's anatomy. The place I enjoyed most was Naoshima, a group of islands 700 kilometres southwest of Tokyo, but that takes a bit of explaining. In Chateau Lacoste, the Provençal wine estate of the property developer Paddy McKillen, with sculptures and buildings by some of the biggest names in contemporary art and architecture, I'd admired the work of Japan's Tadao Ando. His style is pared back, even brutal. Raw concrete in angular shapes with no adornment except for dramatic shafts of light. It's not for everyone, but I like it. Later I heard the full Ando story. In 1986, the architect was invited to Naoshima by a wealthy publisher from the area. This man wanted to help a community whose fishing and salt mining had been destroyed by industrial pollution. The initial project was a children's campsite. Then came the idea of converting derelict village houses into artists' studios. Finally, Ando was persuaded to add two ambitious art museums and a hotel where people coming to see newly arty Naoshima could stay. We spent 2 days of pure magic there. Although the museums were magnificent with their Monets and Hockneys and Warhols, I loved other things, like an old Shinto shrine quirkily restored by Sugimoto, the artist famous for photographing the sea's horizon line hundreds of times, and exuberant sculptures by the dot-obsessed pop artist Kusama, whose giant yellow pumpkin beckons from a jetty. After all this, it was soothing to retreat into the spare beauty of an Ando-designed bedroom and watch the evening sun splash gold across the Seto inland sea. The Art Islands are a massive tourist magnet, boosting local revenues with ferries and buses and B&Bs and cafes selling happy scones or sake cake in several languages. They represent modern, outward-looking Japan, something I didn't see that much of on my only other visit there in 1984. A travel magazine had sent me on an assignment with two photographers and a wonderfully vague brief to get under the country's skin. We started in Tokyo, where a crucial initial task was to recognise the two Japanese characters meaning exit, otherwise whole days might have been lost in the sprawling maze of the subway. We attended a sumo match, hard to stomach, but mesmerising. I interviewed an 89-year-old actor, so talented that he had attained the rank of important intangible cultural asset. And we visited Kyoto, whose temples were exquisite. Then it was time to leave the beaten track and drive north to Tohoku, a region of paddy fields ringed by snow-capped mountains. Because no road signs were in English, the first task each day was to spread a map out on the car bonnet and transcribe the names of towns on the itinerary into attempted Japanese. "Next town, please," the driver would ask. The navigator shouted descriptions of the first few characters. "Tree, window with curtains, pagoda roof." There was only one wrong turn. We slept on tatami mats in ryokans, traditional inns with communal baths so hot that your body felt more fully poached than the fish in the miso broth served at dinner. One evening, while we were eating, a young woman appeared. The innkeeper had asked the only English speaker in town to drop by and see if we needed anything. The next morning, two middle-aged men approached me in the hallway. They had never seen fair hair before and wanted to touch mine. Although that sense of remoteness has gone now, Japan still feels very different in a way that can be difficult to pin down. The first charm of Japan is intangible and volatile as a perfume, the Irishman Lafcadio Hearn wrote in the 1890s. I agree, although I see from my 1984 notebook that I took issue with him at the time. "The first charm of Japan is visual," I scribbled. "Flowers in a vase, food on a plate, wrapping paper on a parcel, every detail considered." Then, "The second charm of Japan is charm. Smiling shop assistants and lift attendants hurrying to help you, making you smile back." Those things haven't changed at all.
Autumn 1990, 7 a.m. A Prindeville Courier's lorry, non-stop from Newcastle West, County Limerick, pulls up outside the UCD Arts Block and deposits a large cardboard box for one Seamus Kennedy. Mrs. Kathleen Kennedy, school principal, respected member of the community, excellent cook, and my mother, was a worried soul that morning. A few weeks previously, the UCD Literary and Historical Society had decided to try and break the world record for the longest continuous after-dinner speech and were looking for willing victims. With one eye on immortality, I'd successfully applied to take part. Other aspirations, like the sub-minute mile, and of course the call-up to the Limerick hurling team, were proving unrealistic at the time. And anyway, how hard could this be? To break the record, three things were required. First, you had to talk for more than 42 hours continuously. Well, I'd had plenty of training in the UCD bar in the months preceding, trying to solve the problems of the world. Secondly, I needed people with reasonable handwriting skills to transcribe what I was saying to send to the Guinness World Record folks as proof. And thirdly, I needed an audience of at least 10 people to listen to my ramblings. That same autumn morning, when the truck arrived, two other lunatics and I, all speaking in parallel, were now over 35 hours into our world record attempt, and it was rough going. The melodic hum of the cleaner's hoovers on the floor of the arts block that morning was making me very sleepy. What had started as a large and enthusiastic crowd was now a hardy audience of 12 who were hungry and, worse, had run out of cigarettes. Yes, you could smoke everywhere at that time. The group included three engineers, Ollie, Jerry and Dave, who happened to be passing two nights previously after the bar closed and had decided to stick around. They were now busy arguing amongst themselves about whose turn it was to go to the 24-hour place in Ranelagh to restock, or could they survive until the opening of the student union shop at 8:30 a.m. A girl called Celine, who I'd never met till I started talking, had taken over transcribing 20 hours previously, and out of pure stubbornness had decided to just keep writing. She eventually wrote for almost 40 hours straight. Her transcribing had a few hours earlier created a bit of a sensitive moment when, with no designated comfort break in sight, I urgently had to use the bathroom but couldn't stop talking and Celine couldn't stop writing. We overcame the challenge by creating UCD's first unisex toilet and modestly using adjoining cubicles with the doors closed. Topics were also now starting to run dry. Nothing was generating the same enthusiasm as the 3 hours I'd spent earlier describing the positions of the Kama Sutra. Engineers, apparently in the pre-internet days, were expert on this subject, and I had an overactive imagination. And yes, Celine did write it all down in great detail. My listlessness was interrupted by a commotion created by the porter arriving over with the aforementioned cardboard box. "I was told by the driver to make sure you got this," he said, "or your mother will kill him." Written on the top were the words, "You might be hungry, love mum." On a collect call home a few days previously, I told my mother that I was attempting this record. When I explained that continuous speaking meant no sleep, she felt she had to do her bit to help. After finishing teaching the previous evening and invoking a few prayers to St. Jude for her wayward son, she took it upon herself to cook a chicken, wrap it up and place it in this cardboard box, along with a loaf of bread, a packet of Gold Grain biscuits, a 1.5 litre bottle of Nash's Red Lemonade, a West Limerick tradition to this day, and still a particularly fine accompaniment to brandy, one Black Forest Gâteau, slightly squashed, and a tin of Quality Street. She also persuaded my father to drop it off to Prendeville Couriers, asking would they mind dropping it off when they were passing UCD the next morning, as I might be hungry. What a gift! All thoughts of stopping were banished from my mind and a renewed energy was found. Someone says, "Tell us about your mother," and I'm off again, as there was lots to talk about. In fact, there was too much to talk about. My mother's cunning plan had run into an unforeseen snag. She had not allowed for the presence of three hungry UCD engineers who practiced their own version of a scorched earth policy. 55 minutes later, and having reached the 5 minute break, I eagerly opened the box to find the remains of one well-picked through chicken carcass, a few cake crumbs, and, "We kept these for you, Ollie Profford," two Gold Grain biscuits. Everything else had been well and truly eaten and drunk. Even the wishbone had been snapped. Jerry won that one. While I missed out on that particular chicken, it did begin a tradition of many future cooked chickens arriving from my mother over the years to UCD. My housemates and I feasted well, whether they arrived through the ever-reliable Prendivals or in the bottom of the bag with the clean washing after a weekend home. One chicken even made it with me to Boston a few years later, just in case, as my mother said, the food on the plane isn't great. Incidentally, I did set a new world record that day, along with the two others, Dara Doherty and Charles Garavan, in speaking individually for 46 hours and 10 minutes. Though my mother suffered one further palpitation when the Jerry Ryan outside broadcast had a technical hitch and was not able to announce the results live. All ended well, though, as that evening in the bar, the three engineering musketeers were feeling guilty enough for wolfing my chicken to buy me a pack of 20 blue and a pint. And by the way, Dave, if you're listening, I still have your UCD and screw jumper 1990 in a drawer at home that you left after you that day, in case you want it back.
The young man looks at me, somewhat bewildered. The Great Gatsby, I repeat. By F. Scott Fitzgerald. Still the blank gaze. And it's then that the woman on my side of the counter steps in to help. One stream of Mandarin later, and before I know it, the male shop assistant is out like a greyhound from behind the bookshop counter, has picked up a stepladder and is propping it up against a wall of books that climbs so high that it actually hurts my neck to peer to the top. 1 minute later, and the young man descends, grinning triumphantly and waving the green-covered paperback book in his hand in my direction. The Great Gatsby it is. In Chinese. It's September 2018 and I'm in Beijing and determined to feed my obsession by adding to my already sizable collection of different editions of Fitzgerald's masterpiece. How much of an obsession? Well, the current count now stands at 28. Yes, 28 different copies of F. Scott Fitzgerald's third novel are currently residing side by side on one very long bookcase shelf. Among those are the book from Beijing, two Italian editions, one bought in Sicily and the other in Rome, a French version, Gatsby, Le Magnifique, purchased in Nice, El Gran Gatsby, bought in Madrid, and then there's my unpronounceable, to me at least, Greek version, procured a few years ago from the somewhat bemused owner of a little bookshop in the former Cretan capital of Hania. The other 22 are all in English, from various publishers, in various sizes, and with various types of cover. From a beautiful hardback Penguin Classic edition, all elegance and decorative gold swirls, to a garish Pulp the Classics edition, complete with artwork depicting a Philip Marlowe detective type in belted raincoat, and with a line below the title declaring, in bold type of course, "When it came to loving, he knew which daisy to pick." Yes, really. That's what it says. I can't quite remember how it all started. I know that I first read The Great Gatsby as a young teenager and fell in love with the writing. For what's not to love about the sheer, evocative magic of the writing? As Fitzgerald transports us, for example, to this particular Gatsby party. In his blue gardens, men and girls came and went like moths among the whisperings and the champagne and the stars. The bars in full swing and floating rounds of cocktails permeate the garden outside until the air is alive with chatter and laughter and casual innuendo and introductions forgotten on the spot and enthusiastic meetings between women who never knew each other's names. Suddenly there you are, wandering among the glitz and the glamour, the backstabbers and the bootleggers, the vacuous and the vainglorious, and all on a warm summer's night in Jay Gatsby's garden on New York's Long Island Sound. The clinking of glasses, the beaded flapper dresses, the men in white flannel trousers, the long cigarette holders dangling from female hands with perfectly painted nails. An image of beauty and perfection, of friendship and gratitude, of love and loyalty that is so superficial, so meaningless, that it decimates countless lives, not least Jay Gatsby's among them. For such a slim volume, The Great Gatsby packs quite a punch. For what F. Scott Fitzgerald shines a light on, what he parades before our eyes, is a society on the skite, an ephemeral world, the boom before the bust. It's a picture of greed and glamour, of people who live only for the moment and for themselves. Careless people, as the novel's narrator Nick Carraway describes his cousin Daisy, the object of Jay Gatsby's desires, together with Daisy's loud, rich oaf of a husband, the stomach-churning Tom Buchanan. And if ever there was a lesson to be learned about the fallout of acquiring money for money's sake, then that lesson is writ large in the story of Jay Gatsby himself. The emptiness, the surrounded by people loneliness, the pointlessness of it all. And yet, what draws me back again and again to the novel is actually Gatsby himself. Yes, he's a fraud and a bootlegger, but just under that quietly arrogant surface, we also get a glimpse of a man who could be so much more. For here is someone who values both loyalty and love, and here too, above all and despite everything, is a man who dares to hope that he can recapture the past, that Daisy will once again be his, that he will find true happiness. Even as a teenage reader, I somehow got the importance of that, what Fitzgerald describes as Gatsby's extraordinary gift for hope. And so I keep returning to Long Island Sound, rereading the novel every summer and seeking out new editions whenever and wherever I can, even those in languages that I don't understand. For what better a gift can there be than Jay Gatsby's gift for hope? For it's hope, after all, that offers us comfort, that keeps us afloat, and that drives us to beat on, boats against the current, daring to dream of better times ahead.
On this morning's programme, we heard The Younger Brother by Dermot Bulger, Urbanski vs. Urbanski by Oliver Sears, Japanese Journeys by Mary Downey, Chicken Gate by Seamus Kennedy, and Boats Against the Current by Rosalind D. The music was In Happy Moments, Day by Day from William Vincent Wallace's Maritana, sung by Eric Hines, Nocturne in C-sharp minor by Chopin, played by Kwanghwa Jung, Lullaby of Takeda, a Japanese folk song by The Red Birds, Don't Stop Me Now by Queen. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey and the producer is Sarah Binchy.
RTE Radio 1.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.